and it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He's so classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, we're not alone.
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have Alejandro Rojas coming up with UFO updates in just a second. Our guest tonight is a longtime, and I mean longtime, researcher for many, many years and decades, going all the way back to the 60s. We have Ray Stanford is going to be on. He's also going to be talking about an amazing discovery that he made at the NASA Goddard Space Center, which I was fortunate enough to actually go down there and see kind of not exactly this discovery, but other discoveries he made. And yes, dinosaurs were walking around at Goddard Space Center, which I think is really something pretty amazing. We're going to be talking about that. He is now known around the world for this, actually, as, you know, he's an amazing amateur paleontologist. His discovery is beyond anything that people have found as far as dinosaur tracks go, mammal tracks and dinosaurs tracks together. Anyway, we'll be talking about that the latter part of the show. First part of the show, we're going to be discussing UFOs, his detection system that he had many years ago, what he found, and then also about ancient discs. You're not going to believe the way they look. Exactly like a flying saucer. So we're going to have images, people watching on YouTube, we're going to have images come up on that so you can see what we're talking about. And I want to thank everyone that supports the show. We absolutely could not do it without you. Thanks so much. Anyone can help out. Doesn't matter where you listen. All you have to do is check out podcastufo.com. All the information's there. We have occasional blogs. We have one a couple of weeks old. And so always welcome guest blogs if anyone's interested in doing that. And I know, I have a good feeling, I know one of the stories Alejandro's going to be talking about, because never in the time that I've been doing the show have I received so many emails about a sighting that came up. I hope he's getting a lot of email too. Alejandro, welcome to the
show.
Yes.
Oh, hey.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good, good. So I would guess that you're getting a lot of email about this Irish commercial flight sighting, all those planes that saw that sighting.
Even Irish commercial, what? No, I'm kidding. Yes, yeah. That is exactly the story I was going to talk about, because it is all over the place in big news, and it sounds like a great case.
Yeah.
So the site that I feel has covered it very well, concisely and thoroughly, and has always done a great job, is The Drive, the War Zone section.
Oh, yeah.
Written by Tyler Rogaway. So it's a great article. You can find links to this, especially if you go to the Open Minds UFO News forum on Facebook. You'll be able to see a lot of people talking about it and some of the information. But it's a really cool case, like some of the other ones that The Drive has posted. And, you know, I should add this because this is important. The Drive feels more like it's okay, even though they're a credible defense website, ever since the New York Times article talking about the DOD having a UFO investigation organization, they feel more able and like it's okay to write about UFO stories. So they have been, from an aviation aerospace sort of perspective, which is really interesting and thorough. And so in their article, they talk about these multiple witnesses, all pilots in Ireland, who saw this object. It was pre-dawn on November 9th, so very recently, about 45 minutes before the sunrise, multiple UFOs being seen. The IAA IAA, which is the Irish Aviation Authority, said that following reports from a small number of aircraft on Friday, November 9th, of unusual air activity, there was a report filed. This report will be investigated under the normal confidential occurrence investigation process. So they are not going to be sharing. Who knows if they'll share the results or even I'm sure they'll say something. But fortunately, somehow, the audio of many of these pilots has come available. So you can listen to that. I know they've got it right here on the drive. But it's really interesting. So one plane said that they weren't showing anything on the radar, but they saw something moving extremely fast. It was described as a very bright light. They said it rapidly it flew alongside the left side of this 787. Before it, quote, rapidly veered to the north and then disappeared at very high speed. Another pilot of a Atlantic Boeing 747 said that there were multiple objects following the same trajectory and that they were moving at extremely high speeds. Then the other pilot kind of chimed in and said, I'm glad it wasn't just me. And then another one said that they also saw these objects and that they were moving very fastly. In fact, their quote was that they were moving, the speed they were moving was astronomical, that it was something like Mach 2. So, very interesting sighting. Another really good one where pilots got involved. Again, they said that there didn't seem to be any fear of collision or that there was no aggressive maneuvering or behavior by these objects. Almost like they were coming in, either taking a look or letting themselves be seen, and then zooming off at a very fast speed, kind of like what we saw in 2004 in San Diego with the Nimitz, the Tic Tac UFOs, or even in 1952 with Washington, D.C., or in Chile, and in many other countries, the same sort of kind of flying in demonstration of this extreme technology and speed, cruising off at very fast rates. So, yeah, great sighting.
I'm wondering, every pilot now probably has their, they're probably texting half the time because they have it on autopilot. I'm surprised that, or maybe they did. Maybe someone tried to snap a picture. Did you hear anything about that or read anything about
that? No. I've heard nothing of any pictures being taken. Yeah. I just got off a long flight from Baltimore and, you know, it's really difficult to take pictures of especially a bright light off in the distance from the ground, even if you're closer from an airplane. So pictures are really difficult unless you have a great camera, kind of like the one I'm using now. It's set up and ready with a long lens. Then it's going to be really hard if it's not a professional. Now, infrared is something different, but of course, commercial airlines don't carry an infrared radar where they're looking for things in the sky. So, yeah, no information on that. And I did want to add one more update. The drive did reach out to the Irish government for the Irish Defense Forces in particular for answers. They had a number of questions, but they got one simple response, which was, the defense forces do not disclose their operational procedures for operational security reasons. This incident is a matter for the Irish Aviation Authority. So essentially, they're not going to say anything, and they're going to leave it up to their IAA to conduct the investigation. And who knows if they'll have a response or not.
Wow. Now, and when in a case like this, I've just noticed that it seems like this has gone viral. When I don't think, you know, you mentioned earlier that, that the guy from the war, whatever it is there, the one that wrote the story.
The war zone on the
war
drive.
War zone, right. He felt more comfortable writing about it since, you know, the December 16th, story in the New York Times. And I think that's having an effect across the board in this, because the Washington Post, I mean,
I can get you to a special screening on Thursday, so just a couple days from now, where you can watch the first couple episodes of the Blue Book Project, Project Blue Book. But email Alejandro or contact at openminds.tv, and I can send you information on that.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, free popcorn and pop, too. This is being put on by the publishers. They're doing. I'm going to be doing a panel during one of these events, and others will at others. So I'm only able – I'm only in contact with the people doing the Las Vegas and Phoenix one, so I can get people into that one for free. And But keep an eye out for other events like this going on.
Yeah, I know Sam Maranto sent out a notice. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah, that's in the Chicago area, so that's going on.
Cool.
And he's fairly easy. I think he's fairly easy to find. I don't know if
I think so. I think he's on Facebook at least, so you can check him out.
Facebook, excellent. So we're running a little bit on time, but I want you to talk about what you did last weekend, if you have, and kind of a
sure. I was at AlienCon. I guess to try to get through it quickly, we were selling stuff. So we had a UFO Congress booth, and I'm wearing the hat kind of because my hair is a mess, but also it's a cool hat. But right over my shoulder here, this was a big hit, what we were selling at the table, this hovering UFO that levitates this lamp that's also a Bluetooth
it's
speaker.
Showing.
And we've got those up on the store now, but they're super cool. Besides that, I had several talks and a panel with Richard Dolan, Stephen Bassett, and Jason McClellan, where we talked about disclosure and post-disclosure. Mostly took a lot of questions from the audience. The History Channel had a big presence there, promoting their television show. There was a lot of people, not as many as Pasadena, but Pasadena was madness. Here, there were a lot of people, a whole lot of people. It was packed, but still. So it was a lot of fun. One of the highlights for me was one of my talks was about Spielberg. And, of course, J. Allen Hynek had a big part of Close Encounters. He was the guy who, inspired Spielberg and gave him the case information. And I talked a lot about Hynek because he's so important and I think he's so cool and a very important person to talk about in that he went in as a skeptic, came out a believer, and really started civilian UFO investigations when he helped the Air Force do investigations. But after my talk, this gentleman came up and introduced himself. It was Paul Hynek,
really?
J. Allen Hynek's son. Yes,
wow.
I was so thrilled. And he was saying, thank you for all the kind things that you said about my father. I'd love to stay in contact. And, of course, I said, well, would you mind coming on my podcast? And he said, yes. So finally, I'm able to get to someone before you do. And I will have Paul Hynek on the podcast soon.
Isn't that great? Does he look anything like his dad?
Not really. Of course, his dad always had a beard and a pipe. Yeah. But, he had a jacket on, very professional, tall, slender guy.
Yeah.
And I looked him up, and he's a professor, an associate professor at Pepperdine, along with a number of starting up companies. He's a very, successful businessman and an impressive person. So that was the thrill of the conference. Besides, and I can tell you more about this later since we're running on, we had a booth next to us that was selling meteorites. And you can see online, I videotaped a piece of Mars, but they gave me a little meteorite. So I'll show you guys that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. On your watch or something. Did I hear about something about your watch?
Oh, no, that was someone else's. Guys, the owner of that company, he's an expert in this. He has a slice of Mars as the face of his watch. Amazing.
Something?
One of a kind item, probably worth at least tens of thousands of dollars. A chunk of Mars that I held was worth over $40,000.
Now, explain that because people know it didn't come back from Mars. So this was a meteorite that landed.
Right.
It did come back, right?
So it's a meteorite. Yeah. So that's essentially what they deal in are meteorites. And that's where this comes from because some people are like, what do you mean? Somebody went to Mars and brought it back? No, it's a meteorite. So that's how we, fortunately, and I don't believe there's a whole lot of them, but chunks that have been dislodged from Mars, probably from asteroid strikes and things like that. And even I think volcanic activity can push objects into the atmosphere high enough where it can escape the gravity of the planet and then float around for probably hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of years before eventually landing on our planet. And then through testing, very similar to the type that we talked about with Chris Cogswell, we're able to show. In fact, that it kind of demonstrates that one of the things I was thinking of, the criteria of proving something is from an ET civilization, because that watch we just talked about is technology. It is from space, but it's not a technology that we're not aware of. So we know this is something that's human built. So that third threshold would have to be met, which is that, you know, it's this space material being transformed into something using a technology we don't know. But it's a demonstration how his watch meets two of those three criteria and why it's so important that those three criteria be met before we call something, you know, ET technology.
Someone just asked in the chat room, did you recently meet with Robert Bigelow?
I did not. Okay. I wish I had, but...
All right. Just wanted to clear that up. They're just wondering if you had. And then another thing in the chat room. Go ahead. Finish that.
I was just going to say that part might have come from, because I did go to a friends and family event where Jeremy Corbell Bell showed us his movie, the Skinwalker movie. Very exciting. We'll have news up tomorrow, too, about his new movie. But... we talked about how there were a lot of people there, and we couldn't disclose all the people there. So people might have assumed Bigelow there was there, but unfortunately he was not.
Oh, okay. And someone also wrote on there the story that you were discussing earlier about the Irish, you know, UFO. They're saying an Irish astronomer claims that it was a meteor. And I wondered if you heard anything about that and if there's any validity or possible validity to that.
I haven't heard a bit about that, but, you know, a lot of people are pointing out that what was described does not seem to fit what this person was saying. However, you know, depending on angles, a meteorite can look strange. I mean, especially in a plane, if it's running somewhat parallel to you, which happens at times because they're up in the air, I guess it's not something we can rule out yet, but thus far I've seen a lot of people saying it's not fitting all of the check marks of what was witnessed. But more has to go into it.
Yeah, would you see a meteor during the day? I mean, I guess it's possible if it's bright enough.
Yeah, I think you can. Yeah. You can see it, and it'll leave a trail because, you know, it's on fire and it's cruising along. Typically, these things, when they're falling apart, there will be pieces of it that will flare. So the brightness you'll see as various different flares of different, I think you've witnessed something like that, where it's kind of more of a flickering, where it gets super bright, then it gets less bright and until it dims completely out as those pieces that luminesce or make the brightness burn off.
And then another thing, it should be earthbound too. I mean, not like a level path.
Well, it should be earthbound, but when you're in the air, and some of these things can come in at a very slight angle where it will look, and if you're on a plane, you know, it's difficult. The angles get very strange, so it's possible something is actually coming down looks level, and there have been, and I think we could probably find them, planes getting pictures of these things looking like they're level to them, but they actually are, you know, being pulled in by the gravity.
Interesting. Well, we went a little long. Sorry about that. So anyway, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll be talking next week. All right.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right. Take care. All right. I apologize for going a little bit long. That was really interesting. I wanted to talk about that possible meteor part of that. So Ray Stanford, our guest, he's been on a number of times. I visited him a number of years ago, did a show down there. I saw some amazing things. I consider Ray a good friend, and we are in touch all the time, and it's my pleasure to have him on. Ray, welcome to the show.
Oh, great to be here, Martin.
Yeah, it's been a little while since you've been on. I think it's been a few years. I mean, you got involved in this dinosaur tracking that just kind of consumed you completely.
Well, it's certainly time-consuming when you make a discovery, and it takes months to realize everything is there, and then you have to take even longer time writing it up in a careful way for a scientific paper.
Yeah, and you did all that, and we will talk more about that in the second part of the show, or the last part of the show. I just wanted to say that's the reason you haven't been on in a couple of years. You've been on National Geographic's been to your house, all kinds of things have happened. You've spoken at Goddard Space Center and all that. All fascinating things. But we were going to talk, when I visited you, I couldn't believe the collection you had and some of the discs that you had, stone discs that look exactly like a flying saucer that are from ancient mounds. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that, but before we get into that subject in particular, for the person that the first time hearing you on this show, we do have a lot of new listeners, and we're also over on KGRA Radio with some new listeners. I'd like for you to fill them in on your background and what got you fascinated in the topic to begin with.
Well, it's hard to say what got me fascinated. Just the mention of something that people can't explain, flying around and doing strange things, I think gets anybody that is in any way analytical, even as a child as I was in 1947. I guess I was 9 years old. And I couldn't stay away from it. It just fascinates me. I don't know what got into me. I skinny little 9-year-old kid jumped off of a swing in the grade school yard and went over to the principal's wife and said, "Mrs. Shelton, when I grow up, I'm going to try to find out what these flying saucers are, and when I do, I'm going to tell the whole world." So she stomped off like a madman who just talked to her, or a mad kid. And I don't know. It catches an interest. And I decided, though, in my teens, as teens sometimes are, impulsive, I got taken in by the hoaxes of George Adamski and the contactee crowd, and interpreted some wonderful, well-documented, well-witnessed sightings that we had in a vein that I consider to be now subjective. I mean, there's a lot of strange things that happen to you if you have a close encounter, at least in my experience. And sometimes when you're inexperienced and highly excitable as a teenager, you can kind of misinterpret it. I mean, we felt like somehow they were reading our minds and causing us to show up and see these things. And I don't any longer think that's the case. I think I have better explanations for it. But it got me, after I wised up to Adamski and exposed the evidence I had that his photographs and stories were hoaxes, and exposed Daniel W. Fry, another contactee, I decided the way to go, the only way to go, was to try to use cameras and electronic instruments to get some kind of data that would be meaningful to mainstream science, that would speak to physicists, and real hard data for hard scientists, we'll say. And it took me a long time to arrange finally the funding for that, but by early 70s, I began to working with a nonprofit corporation, bring in contributions that eventually built a system of tracking these things optically and electronically. It was a total of equipment facilities back then. It was about somewhat over $2 million now. That would be, of course, the order, I guess, of $30 or $40 million.
Yeah.
But we succeeded in using this equipment in the field. The first time we really got a great success was when we had a tip from a government scientist at White Sands that they were being plagued, and we snooped around there on the outskirts of White Sands. But I don't want to get into that too much, because I'd like to talk about something else that surprised me related to UFOs, but ancient. And I guess you know what I'm talking about at this point, Martin.
Yeah. Just to let you know, Ray, we got about a couple of minutes here before we go into our first break. So I may have to interrupt you if it comes to that. But yes, I saw your collection at your house, and it's fascinating. I'd like for you to talk about that.
Okay. Well, I had gotten interested in Indian artifacts back when my dad worked in an oil field and was bringing home Indian arrowheads. And I began to study them, become fascinated, and eventually I began to collect other types of Indian artifacts. Well, then back in the 1980s, the latter part of the 1980s, I had gone to several Indian artifact auctions and received a catalog from an auction called the Old Barn Auction in Findlay, Ohio, and there was a picture of a thing that looked just like a domed disc with spots around its dome and flange, and I said, "Oh my gosh!" And I looked at the text below, and it said, Indian hematite disc, and it said that it had an exclamation mark. This looks like a UFO. So I called the owner of the auction house, and I said, look, I want to buy that. And he said, I can't sell it to you. It's already in the catalog. And this was a hard copy catalog. This was not back in the days of internet auctions. And he said, but, you know, he said, these came out of a collection from back the turn of the 19th and the early part of the 20th century. An old guy back in Hancock County, Illinois, had collected a bunch of Indian artifacts, and when he died, his family stored these things, and recently they decided, well, maybe these are worth something, and they brought them into him, and he said it was astonishing. Here was two discs that looked just like they were flying saucers, and they'd been dug up way back there before we ever heard of Kenneth Arnold and his sighting and descriptions of discs by other people, and so what I did, he said, you know, there's one in the catalog, but I've got one here on my desk. And he said, it astonishes people. People come in and accuse me of being some kind of a UFO nut, having this model of a UFO on my desk. And I explained to him, wait, I wasn't responsible for that. An Indian made it maybe 2,000 years ago. And so I said, look, I want to buy that one. And I did. And eventually I also bought from the guy that got the other one at auction. I got another one. And the one we're seeing on the screen now, actually, I was the last one of the most disc-like type that I got, and that's from Illinois, but from further to the southwestern part of the state of Illinois, and I don't off the top of my head recall the actual size of it, but it's between 3 and 4 inches in diameter, and it looks the part. And I have no explanation of what they were trying to represent unless we make the presumption that an Indian, not having a camera, saw something that impressed him a lot, and he said, I'll make it out of stone and show my buddies what I saw. But that we don't know. Here's two more, three more, actually. These were the early ones. The two, you have top and bottom on the left, and the blue, green, and the red. Now, those were the ones from over in western Illinois, and you can see the size of them and everything there. And one of them was the one that was in the auction, and the other was the one that I bought. And they have one of them has the old sticker down at the bottom right, you see. You can't read it there, but it says Piedrick Collection and Hancock County, Illinois. And that was the old collection that it was in. The one on the right is even more dramatic and larger, and it was found a little further east on the Illinois River. And if we go to the next slide, we might be able to see. I don't know if you can get that up, but that was found while they were clearing trees in 1921 spring on the east bank of the Illinois River in Havana, Illinois. Now, at the time, there was a rise there. There you see on the left where it was, the red line that goes and bends down and shows Havana and it points up to it. And this thing was, it was found when they were digging up trees and the roots pull this thing up. But they didn't realize there was a mound there at that time. The mound there was only about 12 feet high, but it's about an acre in size, and it's now been, of course, both carbon dated, about 2,000 years old, plus or minus 230 maybe or so on either side of 2,000 years ago. And interestingly, also at that same site, they found 22 beads made out of nickel iron meteorite. Two of them are locally here in the Smithsonian. And I mean, this is enough to just boggle my mind. I mean, I realize that these have an excellent collection background. I have the whole collection background on that, the disc number 3 up there in the upper right of who owned it across time. And I'll just mention that the dealer knew of my interest in UFOs, and he was interested in his wife. And I believe his daughter were interested because they had seen something remarkable in their backyard at close range, about 20 feet in diameter. And he said, I said, if you ever come across another one of these things, he said, well, I know an old guy that has one, but he didn't want to part with it. Well, it took him, at least 2, 3, maybe 4 years to talk him into selling it. But finally he sold it, and I bought it from the dealer in artifacts with very good background information. And so I've just been thrilled to have these, and there was the one more that we showed first in the introductory slide there that makes 4 of the ones that look just like what the world today thinks of as the flying saucer UFO.
I guess in this break, we have just 3 minutes. It goes really fast, and I blabbed a little too much. I wanted to know if you can tell the listening audience how you basically ended up so close to Goddard Space Center.
Well, I went through a divorce in my former marriage and came up here and ultimately married a wonderful lady named Sheila, and she was working at Goddard Space Flight Center. Eventually, she became the contracting officer's technical representative over the entire equipment and facilities servicing of the last three Hubble Space Telescope servicing missions, and she got a big commendation from the government for that work. And she was very interested, been interested in UFOs for years. And anyway, we've been married about 32, I guess, years now. And that brought me, because we were only 3 miles from Goddard Space Flight Center, and so I was frequently over there. And one day I was there. I picked her up for lunch, and I dropped her back off and was passing through a parking lot, and I saw a rock sticking out of the grass, and the story is history now that I went over there, and there was the beginning of what has been declared to be the most important discovery of showing interaction of mammals and dinosaurs that's ever been found, and it was right there at Goddard Space Flight Center.
I can't believe, well, first of all, just we'll get into that the second part of the show more, and I actually want you to bring that up again. I don't understand how anyone would notice a rock sticking up in the grass, first of all. And then second of all, all the excavation they did there with all the buildings. You showed me around there when I visited. And, all the buildings there, all the parking lots, there's probably a lot more there that was either destroyed or covered over. But
That's right. It's
just was this near? I'm thinking near possibly an ancient riverbed or something. How?
No, it was in a deltaic floodplain about 110 million years ago that frequently flooded. And in fact, we've found a lot of evidence. I have found the fossils of baby nodosaurs that apparently drowned in probably one of these floods. We know there were nests here because so many baby tracks. The eggs disintegrate because of the high acid in this rather swampy environment. But it was a wonderful place for life if you didn't get drowned in a flood, if you were a dinosaur or a mammal back in that time.
So, we'll talk about that in the second part of the show more. But also, I know you had a sighting right there. We can talk at Goddard or right near Goddard. I remember you telling me you were driving over that way. So we'll be getting back to the show here in just a second here. All right, welcome back. My guest is Ray Stanford. And during the break, we spoke a little bit about the area that it lives in. We're going to be talking more about that later. But when we're wrapping up, we're ready to I still want to talk more about these discs and what the possible use was for them. But the question on that, Ray, have they found any of these in other areas, or is it only in this particular area?
The disc,
yes,
that look like what we think is a UFO looks like, they have been found only in Havana, Illinois, and Hancock County, Illinois, west of there, and there's one down to the south. West of there, the first one that we showed earlier, but if we can go in and look at some of the pictures, I can explain to you a little more about them. But it looks like, here's the hypothesis. When I found these things, I said, I wonder if these were the first things that that they made. And what I found out is I didn't have a confirmation at the time. I thought maybe, the Indians, they feel like if you make an effigy of something, it takes on, to some extent, many of them feel the property, such as the Kachina dolls out west, among the Hopi. And, but if you look at this picture on the left, you see these discs, and they become more and more less like we typically think of a UFO, and more and more practical, rounded edges. Well, I believed, I hypothesized that the original ones, which would have been few, of course, were in response to observation, or at least visual, if not intellectual, contact with the objects and or their occupants, and that it became something that they transferred into a game, even as the Mayans begin to have a ball game that they say is somehow related to the motion of planets. I'm not sure of that, but if that's the white man's interpretation or really the Mayan interpretation. But in this case, I had no evidence that these were the oldest, but as it happened, years later, after I had gotten these objects, it came out a scientific publication with information on the carbon dating of the one there you see on the left, and it would place it right around 2,000, either plus or minus 2,000 years before the present time. But as we get closer to the present time, they got these more rounded edges. Well, the Indians had a game when the white man came that looked, the disc they were using, it looked more like the one on the far right. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was that time. And they had a game that they called chunky, and you could you would roll a disc and throw a sphere that looked for all the world like a mothership, and if they came close to each other, that gave points to the person, I guess, that did the throwing and the rolling of the disc. And the interesting thing is that the Indians were wild about this. The white man didn't like it. They went for a different kind of Indian game, but the Indians were big on betting on this. They bet not only their loin cloth, they sometimes would bet their wives, it was said. It was probably training them, though, intuitively to, by judging the speed of the disc and throwing the, let's look at this. Today in the reports of UFOs, we hear of these long, very narrow cigar, stretched out cigar type things that we might call a mothership in our interpretation. And you've got the discs that supposedly go to and from them. Well, in this game, you've got a thing that's shaped like the mothership, and you've got the disc that they were rolling on the ground. And the points, the greater points were gained by the closer that they stopped to one another, both laterally and distally. So it could be taken as a UFO mothership docking kind of game that they called chunky. And we can't prove that, but it's a hypothesis that tends to be confirmed in my mind, at least a little bit, by the fact that the tremendous age, the 2,000-year-old age of the ones that looked most like UFOs, and as you get more and more toward the white man's coming, they change. Here's a map that you see over on the left where disc 1 and 2 were found, those two at above, and then the far right corner, disc 3. It's interesting that right up there beyond it is the Glassford impact structure. That's where a piece of an asteroid hit back a long, long time ago, before the Indians' time. But I begin to ask myself, why would these UFOs have been spending a lot of time? I don't have any idea. Maybe they were studying the people, but maybe they were also looking at the impact history. If we can move on to the next slide, there's I don't know if you have the next slide that can come up conveniently, yep. But it's quite interesting when you look at that area of the country that has the greatest concentration of impact structures. There you see in the map at the lower left, inside the green circle, that's the area where these kinds of discs are found. And then if we go on to the next slide, I'll compare it to something else. That might be another reason why the UFOs would be studying that area. I'm not sure how easy it is to get back to, to the next slide, but what it shows is, at upper right, this is the New Madrid Fault. That's an earthquake-causing fault. And the most intense area is in the red, but it goes all the way over into the yellow areas. And it now let's go one more slide and compare that to the area where most of the hematite disc and other hematite objects were made by the Indians, and it's quite fascinating. If we can get over there, I realize that there seemed to be some problem navigating. There we go.
No, it's not. Ray, just to let you know, there's a 30-second delay on YouTube.
Okay, 30-second, okay.
Yeah, we're doing it immediately, but it takes 30 seconds.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay, I got it. And anyway, this thing you see in white and red, that was published years ago in a book by Warren K. Moorhead called Hematite Implements of the United States. Isn't it fascinating how the whole pattern, both the white one with the line around it and the red one, echo the New Madrid fault effects? Well, that is easy, perhaps, to understand geologically, because if you're having faulting in that area, you're also altering the course of not only surface waters, but underground waters, and hematite is often formed in aquatic situations where the minerals are carried and the iron oxide grows in various crystalline forms, several different colors depending on the crystalline form. But so it's not mysterious that they take on the same form. But keep in mind that this could be an area that was of interest, because this is a major earthquake fault. It's not compared to the San Andreas out west, but it's said that there have been felt earthquakes from this even over here in the Washington, D.C., Maryland area some time ago. So let's move on now. And I'm going to have to see the next slide first. Remember,
yeah, I know.
The series.
It's the one that's coming up.
But it's coming up, I understand.
Yeah.
And here we go. Now, this one was from the Fort Action culture, and it's small. It's only 1.63 inches in, or 5, whatever that says, in diameter. But it almost looks like a disc with construction panels. And by the way, don't let anybody fool you. You'll hear these stories, fictional stories, that, oh, man, these discs, when you see them, they have no construction panel or nothing. Well, if you're seeing them plasma-covered, as I've learned in my study with instruments, yeah, you won't see the panels. But if the plasma is off, you will see panels. I knew an Indian that ran the Taos Indian Horse Ranch in Taos, New Mexico, and his wife, and he was telling me about how one Indian summer he took a group of tourists up by horseback up into near the area of their sacred mountain there, and a whole group in broad daylight of disc passed over him. He said, Ray, if I'd had a rock, if I'd had the guts to do it, I could have hit them with a rock. They passed so close to us. And he said you could actually see panels that look like units of construction that they were made of.
Hmm.
So anyway, let's take a look at this, and maybe that's a stretch of the imagination that this represents a UFO, but when we go to the next slide, it may not be such a stretch of imagination. We may get some credence here.
Yeah, Ray, just one thing. We have to make sure that we kind of explain things, because a lot of people listening to the show, the majority of the people listening to the show, YouTube's just a small audience. So we have to kind of explain what, I mean, it's a great visual. And just to let the listener know on podcast UFO that listens to the podcast or over at KGRA Radio and the Dark Matter Digital Network, the radio stations that play this show, that I will get something up on my website in the show notes if you want to take a look over there at Podcast UFO.
Well, I invite people to read what I've written on the slides here, and there's nothing really complicated to understand. This is a disc that's quite small, 2 1/8 inch in diameter. It was found years ago, and it was found in southern Ohio in the Fort Action culture area. And it sure looks like ladders. The interesting thing to me is, having studied the physics of these objects, is that when you have a dipolar magnetic field, and we have actual films of this visible data due to plasma being circulating the magnetic field, glowing gas circulating, if you wanted to go in and the thing is still hovering above the ground by the use of this energy, you'd want to go in the place of minimal magnetic strength or zero magnetic strength. You'd want to go in through the center like that, and you'd also want to open your landing gear. Otherwise, it would cause some problems I won't get into. But this certainly looks like somebody might be illustrating the way they left and went into a disc. We can't prove it. But I can't think of any other explanation, and keep in mind that this was the Fort Action culture. People might say, well, that was a kiva, an underground round ceremonial structure that they have out in Arizona, New Mexico. The problem with that hypothesis is that kivas did not exist in that part of the world, in Ohio and northwestern Kentucky and a few adjacent areas. They simply did not exist. No excavation has ever turned up any evidence that it was a kiva culture or that kivas existed. So I think we can dismiss the idea that it represents that, but it sure looks like the way somebody might be. And I had this for several years, and just the other day I came across another disc with the ladders, and we can take a look at that when we get over there. It was made of a different material. This is a sandstone, compact sandstone, but the other one is a semi-translucent kind of a greenish stone that interestingly has a magnetic component to it. There it is. And If you look there, going down toward 4 o'clock, it's a narrow-looking ladder, but look at the one on the left. It looks much brighter, as if the person drawing those on there wanted to show perspective. Well, what that would suggest is he's saying, well, look, it was really not right there at us. It was up above us, so the ladder looks big close up and gets smaller with distance. I'm not saying that's what it was, but that's my interpretation of it. And let's look at another picture of that. I just shot one other angle on it so that you can see the... some people might see these a little better in the next slide, but
and you're saying actually that this is magnetic too?
Yeah, it's magnetic, not strongly magnetic, but it's very appreciably magnetic. It surprised me. And let me mention that all those beautiful discs you're seeing made of hematite, they must have some magnetite in them because they are very appreciably magnetic, some of them stronger than others, which is interesting. But here again, we see these ladders going into the central place, which, by the way, I could sum it to me the most credible UFO cases where occupants were seen. CE3s, as Heineck would have said, close encounters of the third kind, describe occupants going in and out of the middle of the craft. In one case, they very credible, with some children in I think it was in France. The occupants, these small occupants, floated up in the air and went down into the middle center of the object, which would be the top of a magnetic vent, if you want to presume, based on the evidence that I've recorded, that there is a two-pole magnetic field around this object that is moving plasma for atmospheric action and support.
Wow. Yeah, interesting. So, again, just to let the listener know that these images, I'm going to try to figure out how to, this is actually a slide presentation PowerPoint. I'm going to try to figure out how to get this up on my website so everybody can enjoy these and take
That'd
a look.
That'd be great.
They're so interesting. Ray, how many, when I was at your house, I mean, it was looking all around at your dinosaur tracks everywhere, but you were able to amass a good collection of these.
Well, there are only four of the ones that look most like disc, and then you get the gradients, such as I showed in that time frame thing a while ago. I didn't show nearly all of them, but I collected, of course, these disc-shaped ones are very rare. I only know of two genuine ones of that are left out that I like to get in into my, as I call it, my hematite UFO hanger, and the rest of them are transitional toward the more practical aspects of the game, which I take as being a UFO mothership symbolically manifested docking game, from the Indians seeing these things go up to an elongated thing in the sky. And it's a very, very strange game to figure why somebody would ever come up with such a thing that, in fact, is so odd that it had no appeal to the white man at all. And but here's some of them on the table. And you see the one there with the ladders. You can compare the size to the two brown ones with the little odd figure, which is actually from the Chancay culture of Peru. Those are the ones from Western Illinois. The beautiful one on the left, the dark brown one, that one is from Central Illinois, there on the Illinois River at Havana on the east side, found in 1921. I go back and say that those two brown ones were found either in the latter part of the 19th century or the very first part, before Piedra died, of the 20th century. You can see different sizes of the disc, and you'll notice around some of these have much rounder edges, and there's one down there at the 4 o'clock position that is actually cone-shaped that does have a convex bottom. It's a very high-grade hard hematite, very dense hematite, and believe it or not, there's been a UFO film by some physicists that I think we're going to see in a bit here that was shaped just like that. It was a movie film, 16-millimeter movie film, that was taken by two physicists at Oak Ridge National Laboratory back, I think, in the 60s or early 70s. I forget the date.
Wow.
So we can move on.
Yeah. We're taking a break in just about 2 minutes or so, just to let you know. And during the 2 minutes, the people in YouTube are going to get a video that we're going to be showing of your exploration down in at Goddard. That's coming up in a little bit. So, and we just have about a minute and a half before we go to break. So, have you actually seen any of these, like in a museum or any other type of collections?
Well, yes. Of course, there's a collection these came out of, and and but there are people who have discs. Not of them. I don't know. Well, I only know of two other sources that have the UFO like ones. One of them is now owned by a farmer that is about 90 years old, and he got it from another elderly farmer out in Illinois, and I'm waiting to get it because it is a spectacular disc too. But it was also dug up just a long, long time ago. And but these are the few. This is where the disc thing started out, and I think the idea of the game. But the game became contagious. It's like soccer has taken over the U.S. in recent years. The first there were the Hopewells, and then the Mississippians took it up, and Cahokia down there that has the biggest structure by Indians in North America, their biggest mound there, they took up this game big time. They had the whole Cahokia site had a big, huge central field for playing this game of Chunky. And as it turns out, some anthropologists have theorized that it, in fact, this caused the spread of the Cahokia Empire because got people involved with the game, and as they became involved in the game and got to know each other, they took on more of the traits and the culture, and thus the empire spread. We don't know, but that is, it makes pretty good reasoning to me. What we do know is that this game became an obsession.
How about that? Okay, so we're ready to go to break. All right, we're on with Ray Stanford, and we'll be right back right after these messages. So do you think, would you consider, someone was saying that you probably have one of the best collections outside of a museum of these Chukka, whatever they are, stones. Would you say that's possible?
Well, not of the discs totally. There are some people have more of the discs, but I have most of the UFO-like ones. There are, as I said, there's two that I know for sure that I've seen. One of them I've held in my hand that are out there that I haven't been able to acquire yet. But, you know, these were the first photos somebody got of a UFO. This is the Indian's photo, you might say, I think, if I'm interpreting it correctly, of what she or he observed and then laboriously made. Imagine making this out of hematite, which has a tremendous hardness. Yes. Work with it is the challenge.
Yeah. Do they make any stone tools out of that?
Yes. There are quite a few little celts used in splitting wood that they made out of it. And there are also some other fancier objects that are made out of hematite. It was a beloved material, but you don't see as many as the hematite collectors would like to see because it was just hard to work with. And there are various grades of hematite. And the Indians liked hematite so much that they found out, something that most people don't know, but they would take limonite, which is a hydrated iron oxide, which hematite is, and they would fire it and make it hard on the outside, lose its water, and it would make it hard and hematite on the outside. But I have objects that show, broken open, that the limonite, that they discovered this process, that you could dehydrate the limonite and turn it into hematite. So you would have to give the Indians some credit for a little bit of petrochemistry there, we'll call it.
How about that? All right, welcome back. My guest is Ray Stanford, and we've been talking ancient artifacts that sure look a heck of a lot like what they call a flying saucer. Any triangle ones? That wouldn't really work if it was a game, right?
In fact, I did find two. I was coming back from an Indian artifact auction in Ohio, and I was in West Virginia, and I stopped by one of these brand-new store that they were selling various kinds of frozen yogurt. And there was a big cliff over to the side on the property adjacent to it, and I went over there, and lo and behold, there had washed out of the cliff and fallen down below two black stone objects that were rounded, just like, as a matter of fact, just very much like one of the triangular UFOs that I filmed from an airliner at 39,000 feet on 12/12/77. I'm not saying those were UFO effigies, but I have no explanation of what they were. I still have one of them. Somebody, put one of them in the pocket and walked out of my living room with it, but the other one I still have, and it does look like what I filmed, except what I filmed had more details than this does.
Yeah, how about that? So, Ray, I don't know. You know, we got an hour left here. We can go into your into the dinosaur. I know it's off the UFO topic, but I do mention that on my show occasionally, about once a month or so. I do go off topic, And this is kind of the show for that. But before we go into that, just one thing I would like to talk about the UFO subject. You have seen, I know I asked you before and you never really gave me any answer, but you have seen more UFOs than anyone I've known. You have filmed many, many UFOs. And I guess the question I have for you is, why do you think that you have all these sightings? I mean,
okay, let me put that in a context.
Okay.
I've also found more dinosaur tracks than anyone in the eastern United States.
Yeah.
More tracks of the flying reptiles, pterosaurs or pterodactyl, people call them, because I'm looking for them.
Uh-huh.
I've trained myself to know how to look and to properly evaluate what I'm looking at, and that's the clue. Now, when you carry, as I did for 30 years, a heavy camera with a big glass lens on your shoulder, giving you a neck ache often, you ask yourself, why the heck am I doing this? Well, you keep looking at the sky to try to make it worthwhile and hope you see something. And that is what I did. But let me mention that the films I've been talking about, most everyone has multiple witnesses, including excellent witnesses, and in other cases, not only the films, but electronic and gravitational magnetic measurements simultaneously in broad daylight.
Ray, you know, I remember when we were discussing some of your sightings, at least a couple of them, and probably more, but I just remember you mentioning this, that you had a feeling first. And I want to tell you also that I've had other people, and I know you listen to the show a lot of the time, but I've had people on the show that have told me exactly the same thing. And can you describe what that feeling is?
Well, yes. Now, let me say that back in my teens, when I was a believer in George Damski and so forth, I was able to get that feeling for a sighting, and I thought it was a telepathic message. I don't believe that any longer. We got a tip from a government scientist at White Sands in July of 1978. That if his sister had seen me on the Phil Donahue show with Hynek, and she called and said, "My gosh, my brother, who he was a physical scientist out there, says that if you've got that equipment, you better get out there and sneak around the periphery because we're being plagued by them and have a directive to get any kind of evidence we can get on this that we are capable of getting." And we went out there. And we got spectacular results. But what happened is, on the way out there, our financier was with us, the guy that put huge money into this. Wonderful guy. And he was in along with us, with my wife and me and our eight-week-old baby. And after we had a sighting, I commented, I said, you know, I felt that before it happened. And they said that they did, too. And later on, they experienced this same feeling before the object showed up. But what we found out during that event, we recorded the extreme low frequency magnetism emitted by these objects. It had a direct correlation with their maneuvers. And by golly, when you look at it in the context of scientific studies unrelated to UFOs about how this ELF in this range affects the human nervous system and brain, you begin to understand something. A part of it is in the deep, restful sleep range. Now, if you're asleep and one of these things comes around, that might explain why one of a couple gets up to go to the bathroom, sees an incredible thing at close range out the bathroom window, can't wake the spouse to see it because it's weird. That cannot be awakened. That might be explained by the fact that when ELF in this range is affecting the brain, it actually replicates what is impinging on it, and if it's deep restful sleep, it could be very hard to wake you up. But if you are awake, it gives you a wonderful, rested, relaxed feeling that we jokingly call, you would spell it in the dictionary, E-U-P-H-O-R-I-A, euphoria, but we spell it U-F-O-R-I-A, because based on the recordings we made in broad daylight with multiple witnesses and instrument recording and film, we believe that this range of frequency, it can be perceived consciously, and it makes you feel surprisingly good. You might feel like when you wake up on an autumn morning and the atmosphere is so clear and in this atmospheric high, that kind of thing, or you might be a kid that all of a sudden realized, hey, today's the day I have that secret meeting in the woods with my best girlfriend. I mean, it's the kind of thing, this energy, and it's a wonderful thing, and we call it euphoria, and I believe that people could be trained to become walking, talking UFO detectors, but I'm not going to go into the business of training them, or I'll be called a con man.
Wow. Yeah, I remember one of the sightings you said was actually on an airline. You mentioned you saw back something in 1979.
That's right.
But I remember you said you reached over and grabbed your camera. And
well, that's right. Yeah. Well, I tell you what. We had taken off from New York. This was 12-12-77 Brandeis Flight 9. And as we were coming, we were to what they call pea soup. We were in clouds. And we were flying out of New York City to Dallas-Fort Worth and Brandeis Flight 9. And what happens is I felt this, which I'd experienced before. And I said to my wife, who was right beside me, of course, in the airline seat, I said, listen, I said, you're trying to go to sleep, but I feel it. When we get through the clouds, there's going to be one out there. I can feel that so strongly that I felt before. And she said, look, she was pregnant. She was going to have her first child in May, as it turns out. And this was December. And she said, look, I've got to get some sleep. I think I'm coming down with a cold. I have a headache. I feel nauseated. I've got to get, don't you, if you see one, you showed me enough of these things since we got married. Don't wake me up. And I said, okay. But guess what? Then she said, wait a minute. Wake me up if you see a mothership, because I haven't seen one. And believe it or not, about 2 hours later, well, when we got out of the clouds, here was this beautiful object pacing our plane. And I said, I've got to film you. I've got to film you, guys. And I grabbed on my seat. And unfortunately, I had the case. It had two pad-like pads on top. I had the lockdown. I had to unlock them. And I got really upset that I couldn't get it. And the thing took off like the proverbial bat out of hell and shot straight up, just straight up at tremendous speed and left. But about 2 hours later into the flight, I saw what appeared to be the same type of object, but instead of being looking with a surface that looked like liquid mercury, it had a surface that was so black it seemed to absorb every light ray that hit it, unless it was hit at a very narrow oblique angle, and then the sunlight would reflect off of it there. But I began to get film, and I got multiple minutes in broad daylight of this object, and it led me, my camera, of course, to the big carrier, mothership, whatever you want to call it, that was out there that we now know from data in the film was about 165 miles away from the camera, but it was huge. And we have size data on this big thing, and these objects were going to and from it like crazy at incredible speeds. There were triangular objects, there were discs, and I got wonderful film, and the whole story really well documented. I don't want to get into that because we're going to try to get into 10 million years ago.
Yeah.
But that was a prime example of feeling the euphoria and being able to benefit by it and getting a film.
Right. Before we get into 10 million or more years ago, I just wanted to allow that if someone wanted to call in, we're going to put the call-in number up, and if you're over at KGRA Radio, that number is 603-967-4030. And what I'd like to allow is if anyone wants to call in and talk about UFOs before we change the subject. And so if no one does speak right up, then we are going to move on to the dinosaurs. So along those lines, Ray, you actually had a sighting when you went to pick Sheila up one day, right? At Goddard.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, that was in 1989. At that time, this was before she went with the Hubble Space Telescope servicing missions, and she was in public affairs at Goddard. And I had, back in those days, before 9/11, so you could park your car right in front of Building 8, which is the administration building, and I had in my car with me, in its case, a 1,000-millimeter telephoto on a 35-millimeter camera. That's a 20-power lens, and it was a high-quality, expensive lens. And I pull up there, and lo and behold, there is a disc-shaped UFO on the western horizon. And at that point in time, it had what I now know to have been plasma around its surface, but it was like a biconvex disc, except it was like two cones, and flange to flange, and but as I filmed it, it actually, the plasma moved off its surface and began to contour the dipolar magnetic field. Now, if people don't know that term, you would probably, though, in school have had a bar magnet under a piece of paper and scattered shavings around, and you see that pattern. It has two poles, north and south, we'll call them, and that's a two-dimensional version of it. But this looked like a three-dimensional version in the sky because you can't see a magnetic field. But if there is plasma, which is emitting light because of the energy in it and the electrons moving from one orbit to another and emitting light, you will be able to see it. And I could see it. And I got one absolutely, I think it was the fifth photograph, spectacular, beautiful photograph of this beautiful field around this object. And at that point, once the plasma is off the surface, you can actually see that there are what I call these compositional panels that I talked about earlier, like in that disc we saw. You can actually see them on the surface. It's not a blob of light. It's not something you can't see something. You can actually see the panels. But most spectacularly, this beautiful three-dimensional magnetic field around it. So that was in November of 1989, taken from right in front of the administration building of the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. And when the thing left, I rushed in and told my wife, and even called someone from I forget the name of the local UFO organization to tell him about it. But I made a drawing for Sheila and so on and so forth. And I was really, when I got the pictures back, I was just so thrilled because I tell you the truth, I'd be able to convince myself, you imagine that part about the field. That's too good to be true. But there it was on the film, just beautiful.
Amazing, amazing. So someone just tried to call in and they hang up. So if you are calling in, just keep in mind that I'm not going to interrupt Ray while he's talking, so just hang there, and then I'll introduce you. And also make sure that you have your radio or computer or whatever it is you're listening to. Make sure that you have that muted at that time if you would. So we're still taking calls. Everyone wants to call in. Otherwise, we're going to switch the subject here really quickly. And so, Ray, you have also, for the person that has not heard you for the first time, this is their first time listening to you, I want to say. You mentioned earlier about your book on Socorro. Have written the best book. There's been a couple of others, or at least one other. Or I remember you mentioning Lonnie Zamora's daughter told you that you had written the best account of what happened.
Well, yes. But you see, Lonnie told her that she, when she turned 21, she said, "Dad, you never want to talk about this. Could you please, I'm 21, can you please tell me what you saw?" Go into detail. And he said, "Look, see all that file over there? Everybody sent me articles, people writing about this. Nobody got it right." I said, "If you want the full story accurately, there's only one person that got it right, and that's Ray Standard in that book over there that you see on the shelf." And she said, he said, "If you'll read that, you'll know everything that I saw, and you'll learn a lot more." And so she contacted me and was very appreciative.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, that's still, in my book, one of the best, you know, it's in the definitely in the top 10 sightings. And would you consider, if you could be biased, would you agree with that?
It is certainly, in North America, it is the absolutely best documented close encounter of the third kind, where a person, where the policeman, Lonnie Zamora, Socorro policeman, saw two diminutive occupants in what appeared to be white coveralls outside the craft. Yes, it is certainly North America's, in my opinion, most credible close encounter of the third kind.
And you were there shortly after. The one part I don't think we've ever discussed on the show is how you found out about it. How did you find out about it?
Yeah, well, I didn't know about it, and I got a call from a friend of mine, Bob Matthews, in Corpus Christi, Texas, my hometown down there. And he said, "My gosh, why aren't you in Socorro?" And I said, "Why should I be in Socorro?" And he said, "Well, the policeman there has seen a craft landed with some occupants outside." I said, "Oh, my gosh." And suddenly my mother and father sent me a clipping out of the Corpus Christi paper talking about it. I think it was headed, "Long, tall object has hot feet," which is kind of stupid. But anyway, I made arrangement and took off for Socorro and arrived there on Monday. It was on a Friday evening that this happened, and I arrived there, and I happened to arrive the very time, same time, just a little bit after Hynek had arrived there. And so now Hynek knew me from correspondence on another important UFO case back in 1959. And so when I told Lonnie Zamora to tell him he was going to be interviewed by him, tell him that Ray Stanford is here and would like, you know, to get together on this, Hynek actually, this, over the protests of New Mexico State Police Sergeant Samuel Chavez, who didn't like any of these investigators coming in on what he thought was a secret government craft that had landed there, Hynek insisted that they let me come out to the site while he was questioning Zamora and Chavez. And that's how I got to the site and got turned on to some remarkable things and wrote the book, which was published in 1976. It took me years of research to try to make sure that everything was accurate. I did it so well that I had a lawyer read it before I published it to make sure nobody could sue me. And he said, "Ray, you missed your calling." He said, "I think you better go back to school and become a lawyer." And in Austin later, I had another lawyer friend read it, and he said the same thing. I really did work, though, to make a good case. And it was a lot of fun, but nobody knows the work that goes into an important case like that if you're really going to document it.
Well, I got to tell you, when we first started talking back several years ago, I'm thinking, I don't know, maybe five or six years ago, you sent me the book, and it was an excellent read. You still have some of those books, right?
Yes, I do have. I have. They're the original first edition, and I have quite a few copies left. Not a huge number, because most of them have sold, but I have copies that have, you know, the dust jacket. They look like you would have bought them back in 1976, and it, you know, people want them. I can tell them they can order them, and the cost is with the shipping is $55, and that's cheap compared to what some guys I know various places have sold them for. I know people
Amazon
have sold them up to $450 a piece.
Right.
But I'll sign them for you if you want them signed, with or without your name in the signing, and get them to you for that price by priority mail with tracking.
Yeah, well, just anyone that wants to order a book, and I got to tell you, it's one of my very favorite books. I really, really enjoyed it, and I let someone borrow it. I've been waiting to get it back. They loved it too. But anyway, anyone wants to order a book, just write me at martin@podcastufo.com, and I'll pass it along to Ray, and you're welcome to. All right, so we don't have any callers on the UFO topic, so we're going to move on. And we're going to talk about your discovery. On the first break, you mentioned that you were in the Goddard Space Center parking lot waiting for Sheila, and you happened to see a rock stick out, and something made you get out of the car and go check it out. Is that the first set of tracks? You found other tracks before that, right?
Oh, yes. I've found hundreds and hundreds of them.
Yeah.
It's been now 25 years, and I blame my my eldest son, who talked me into buying a book on tracking, and Dr. Martin Lockley's book, who's now been on my track papers. He's been one of my co-authors, and that's how I got into it. I mean, I really wasn't interested in dinosaurs and tracking, only superficially for the purpose when my kids were growing up of showing them the tracks down in Texas. But when we got into it and I began to find these things, I have found hundreds of tracks and small trackways of dinosaurs and flying reptiles. I have the only flying reptile tracks that have ever been found in the eastern USA because people don't know what to look for. Most people can recognize one of the types of dinosaur track, your three-toed track that you might have seen in Close Encounters of the Third Kind after T-Rex had walked there. But most people don't know what a flying reptile's track looked like. But if you studied Lockley's books, you find out, and that's how I begin to find these. They're rare, but not all that rare that you can't find them around here.
Now, is there a certain type of rock that you have to look for where these impressions actually stayed and remained?
Yes. In the first place, if you want to look for dinosaur age tracks, whether it's from the mammals or the flying reptiles or the dinosaurs, what you do, you go to your local geological survey, and you want to look in stream beds where there are outcroppings of rocks of the age of dinosaurs. Here, they are, of course, there are what are called Lower Cretaceous or Early Cretaceous, and the ones I find are about 110, 112 million years old. But you'll need to get your geological maps and look for them. Here they have a nice deep green for that outcropping. And you're not going to find dinosaur tracks where they were the rocks of the wrong age. But here locally, they can either be various shades of brown, or they can be beautiful, even combinations of hematite, a red form of loosely consolidated hematite and limonite, which is yellow, and that makes a beautiful combination. Sometimes you'll believe it or not, you'll have a red track on a yellow background, or vice versa, and that has caused me and many other people that have seen them to say that Maryland has the most beautiful dinosaur tracks in the world.
How about that? So your discovery was extremely important, and also because there were mammals involved too, right?
That's correct. Yeah, in fact, on the sled, Ed Goddard, it's about 2 square meters size, about the size of a decent size, but not large, not huge, a dining table. And it's 8.5 feet long and 39 inches at the very widest. And on there are nearly 100, let's be conservative and say 90 footprints, but at least 40, maybe a few more than 40 of them are by mammals, and by at least 3 kinds of mammals, the tracks of which have never been seen before, including, when we published it, the largest published track of a mammal from the dinosaur age has ever been seen, bigger than an adult badger's track, 4 inches long, with very evidence of very sharp claws. But you had these little mammals, the smaller ones, digging around in what back then was clumps of feces from probably larger dinosaurs from the looks of it. And the flies had laid their eggs in there, and the larvae, and there's some big flies and some big larvae, and these mammals are digging them out. You can see where some of them were dug out, and you see their claw marks where these little guys were going after the goody protein sources in the feces. And but all the while, tracking slowly, 4 trackways through the whole thing going west, are the tracks of small flesh-eating dinosaurs. And they are, we know they're tracking slowly because of the close spacing of the footprints. We did a calculation. We found out these little guys were moving less than 0.5 mile per hour, but there's method in the madness. They wanted to move slowly so as not be not distract the mammals from their eating the larvae, so they can jump and eat the mammals.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's a well now a dog eat dog society, I guess.
Yeah.
And but that big mammal was so big it could have eaten the mammals, or in fact the theropod, the small theropods that were eating the mammals, and it could have eaten some of the flying reptiles. We have a footprint of a pretty good size flying reptile, probably had a wingspan of 18 feet or 15-18 feet.
Wow.
And I do have elsewhere, it's yet to be published, but I have a footprint of a mammal, left front footprint of not a mammal, a flying reptile, a pterosaur. You'll know them as pterodactyl, maybe. We have one that is 15 inches long. It's the biggest ever found. And we have the feeding traces that are compatible size with that, show where it stuck that big beak down into the muck and pulled up to pull whatever was living under there out to have a meal.
So tell me, what did the Goddard Space Center have to say about the discovery?
They were delighted. They were thrilled. In fact, when the paper came out on the evening of the 31st of January this year, the Earth Science Division threw in a big party in building 33, which is the Earth Science Facility, in the atrium there, and we have the nice we have a full size, total detailed, three-dimensional reproduction made from a latex mold and carefully colored exactly like the real thing, up there on the wall at an angle with a map explaining it below, which we'll see some images of. And the thing is that, I mean, they were packed in there. They were thrilled. I'll tell you a funny story to show you the human side of this. When I discovered this track and finally announced it to public affairs, there's a section of Goddard Space Flight Center that are known as the facilities people, and they were getting ready to build, I did not know this when I found this, a $35 million flight projects facility, and part of it would have a pylon go right down in the middle of where this was. Well, this means, we got to stop and get that thing out of here, those tracks. And so here they're delayed, and they're worried about it costing money, and they were very upset and let it be known. And what is this guy coming along finding dinosaur and mammal tracks when we're building an Earth Space Projects Flight Projects facility? Well, however, I have to say that The guy in charge of that came up at the big party that was thrown afterward and greeted me in the most wonderful way. He said, thank you, congratulations. He said, you know, I was upset when this happened, but he said, I want to congratulate you. This is wonderful. And I say, all's well that ends well. And the authorities, in fact, we had to, the paper shorter than I would have liked. I wrote it originally a lot longer, but like I talked, but it actually we reduced it down because they wanted to go ahead and get this thing published. And the longer your paper is, the longer it takes the peer reviewers to study it and pick it apart if they can, and so on and so forth. So and we succeeded. It was published in Nature's Scientific Reports, and everybody was just thrilled. The New York Times did a beautiful coverage on it with very good pictures, as I show in the slides, and so did the Washington Post, and some wonderful TV coverages were done on it. The best TV coverage was on a network that I don't normally watch. It was on Fox News Sunday. But the wonderful interviewer there did a marvelous job, and he was deeply appreciative and didn't bring any politics into it at all. And if one can go there and see it, it's the best interview with me that was done this whole time. And I was all over the world on TV, and I had to sit there for day after day as media people would come in and want to do their interviews. And one day I was there, just sitting there, no, waiting for the next interview, and here comes an important-looking guy with guys in black suits.
Uh-oh.
Around
men
him.
In black.
Oh boy!
Yeah.
And but they look like, you know, they might be Secret Service people or something. Well, it turns out, but then they got close enough, I realized the director of Goddard was there, but the guy with him was. Congressman Steny Hoyer, he's still congressman, but he was the what's called the minority whip at that time, and he was coming there, and he walked up and stopped, and I'm just sitting there, I didn't realize it was Hoyer, but he stopped and he said, "Who found this wonderful thing?" He shouted that out, and I confessed, and he said, "Look," he said, "I have some questions. I'm excited, interested in this." And there, you'll see a picture of him with the director over the right side, Steve Colise, with him. And he asked wonderful questions. I never expected this of a politician, but he was genuinely interested and asked some great questions, which I really appreciated.
Wow. Isn't that something? And then you were at National Geographic, right in the magazine. And
that's right. Yeah, they did a coverage back in November of last year of flying reptiles, pterosaurs, and they did they have a picture of me sitting in my living room chair, chair in the corner of the living room.
Yeah, yeah, I got to see that. So this is kind of amazing. So let me just ask you this kind of oddball question: at any point when you were talking about dinosaurs, did anyone actually find any connection with you in UFOs and talk to you about it?
Yes, a few of them did. And and when I explained that my approach to UFOs is just as scientific and as skeptical as it is when I come across something in a stream bed and ask myself what it is, I try to be objective. And and those that learned about it and asked me about it were quite accepting of my position on it. I don't take the position. I don't tell the media, gee, man, there's little green men out there or something like that. I say that apparently there is a sophisticated technology that if we can tap it with instruments and get into it, it can be of immense value to humankind. And they understand that. And they now that, of course, the New York Times article has helped public relations on this, I think.
Yeah.
Although I'm not really impressed with the infrared videos, still, it has helped a lot. And so everything has gone quite well. Nobody has written me off because I'm involved with scientific UFO studies.
Yeah, that's good. And I know, just going back to that just a little bit, I know there are people from Goddard that actually have visited you and have talked to you about your images and everything else, right?
Well, that's right. In fact, there's one major scientist there, a senior scientist who, in fact, I have reason to believe from what I've heard that he is the most, in scientific papers, scientifically cited his papers of any scientist at Goddard Space Flight Center. And he's been here several times, and three of the times, maybe four or five of the times, he's looked at those hematite UFO discs, and he said, Ray, those have to be the most convincing evidence I've ever seen that extraterrestrials visit us long ago. And here's a high-level scientist saying this, and I don't say, what do you think of these? He tells me this spontaneously. He keeps seeing them and making that comment, and it's been that reaction to a lot of people. Now, some of them, though, are intimidated, and they don't ask. That looks like flying saucers. I'm not going to get into this subject. But this top-level scientist and others who have been there have had a very positive and very open-minded reaction.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was so glad because that this whole thing happened to you, going back to the dinosaur thing, just because I think that you really have, you have a lot of respect due to you, because I know you've taken, the UFO field seriously. And for you to actually find these tracks, I know that you had in your basement, was it the molded copy that you had? I know you were looking at this, studying this thing for a long time, right in your basement, right?
Yeah, this is the actual one that's displayed in Building 33 at the Goddard Earth Science Facility. Now, it was made, a latex mold was made of the actual slab that I found after it was cleaned off, and then they cast it into some kind of white material, and then colored it exactly to match. And then, even as when I find these in the stream bed, you'll find fine silt that's drifted in the low places and makes you notice tracks you won't notice. So they wanted me to make the big notosaur track and the one big sauropod track visible. I'm doing this, and I scattered this silt around, and my gosh, when it began to fall into other places and little patterns, my gosh, there are all kinds of tracks on here. And here with all this drama of the interaction of these animals going on, and when I saw that there were mammal tracks with interaction of theropods and these flying reptiles that were landing right nearby, I called this chief scientist at Goddard, and I said, Jim, are you sitting down? And he said, yes. And I said, look, there are mammal tracks on there with those. And he says, oh, my gosh. He said, I think we got something really, really important. I said, you bet we do. And so there it was. It's the biggest congregation. There were more tracks on that slab at Goddard in 2 square meters than in the entire age of dinosaurs from all over the world had been found summed together right there. And I'll have to say, they chose a good place that 110 million years ago would be Goddard Space Flight Center. I can't say they smelled it coming, but anyway, it was a popular place back then.
Now, the one thing, did they go ahead and build this building that they
went in and built it, and they put one column right down. Had I not discovered this, sometimes I think I'm on an unconscious rescue mission because had I not found this, had I even found it 2 weeks later, I would never have stopped them. They would have gone ahead and would have put this down and would have destroyed this incredibly scientifically important column. But it had been cut out on the north side by heavy equipment years before, and on the on the west side and the east side, and it. But the piece was there originally where it was when the animals stepped on it, and so that's what happened. But at Goddard, most of the things have been ground up, as you suggested earlier, by heavy equipment. But you'll find some tracks and pieces of tracks that are around in the ravines where they had dumped this stuff that they moved to make the basements and the buildings. And so there's still some to be found. But we've tried to find other big slabs, but we cannot find any.
Yeah, I mean, I would think this is almost like a gold rush in a way, with something important like this is found, where you'd really want to scout. Scout the area. So it sounds like you've done that, more or less.
That's right, and we've cautiously cautioned the people at Goddard that if they're caught finding and stealing these things, they could go to prison. It's government property, and yeah. We try to be very careful and to discourage that. Although we did find a place where someone had apparently dug out a track, and not only that, but a major scientist, Goddard, and I that got hooked on trying to track dinosaurs after the find there. We were out one day and we found a track, but at that point, you know how government regulations are, we didn't have a clearance of where you would take any tracks if you found them. You leave government property where it is. So we just moved it out of the stream so it didn't get washed away and put it under a bush. But guess what? The news had already broken about the finds there. Somebody was watching us. We went back a couple of days later and somebody had seen us and had stolen the track. We don't know who stole it.
Oh, my God. Wow. And so... but there's no other, there's no type of detection. I mean, it would just, if you try to detect something like that, like under the grass or under, you know, the layer of dirt, layers of dirt, there's just no way of doing it because it would just show up as a rock, right?
Yeah. Well, we have some pictures that show a lady pulling an interesting-looking red electronic box, and it's ground-penetrating radar that Goddard paid to be brought in from New Mexico. And she went over the area, and there are several areas they thought, oh, my gosh, we may be hitting another slab of these tracks on it.
I see.
But as in one of the pictures was quite funny, one guy dug down where the radar said it should be, and all you see is the lower part of his hips and his legs sticking out of the ground. And I put a thing there that he says, it's only clay. It was an iron-bearing clay that was reflecting the radar, and so we did not succeed in finding any other slabs. And we have looked all over Goddard for it, and there are no, so far as we've been able to find anyway, slabs like that right at the surface. But only in that case, only the big squeezed-up edge of the notice our track was visible above the grass. But why would I notice it and nobody else? Because I track dinosaurs, and it's like an astrophysicist told me, he said, Ray, every day for 7 years, 4 and 5 days a week, I've walked down there past that within 4 to 6 feet of it, going to the cafeteria, and I never saw it. I said,
yeah.
Look, your mind is looking up. You're an astrophysicist. I'm looking down.
Or you're looking both.
I'm looking both, is the truth of the matter. But hopefully not at the same time, at least when I'm driving. I had parked in the parking lot because I saw this, and I said, I've got to have a look. I walked over there, and I thought, my gosh, notosaur tracks are rare. And here's the most beautiful big notosaur track that I've ever seen right there at Goddard Space Flight Center.
Now, the notosaur is like an armored dinosaur, right?
Yeah, he's like a tank on four legs.
Yeah.
He's very armored as that. As we show in a model in some of the pictures from the public affairs out there, got some pictures. I brought a model of a notosaur. They have these big ridged armored on, and some of them are actually big spikes that stick out. But if they're babies, they don't. They grow as they grow older. They get these rougher and rougher surface.
Now I do believe when I visited you that in your own personal collection you had a dinosaur track, but there was also a cat footprint. Am I getting that right?
No, not. Not a cat. No,
oh, okay.
No. We have bigger tracks of mammals than the one at Goddard that's 4 inches long. We have some spectacular tracks that I've found, and one of them looks like a gigantic lion track, mountain lion,
yeah.
But it's bigger than a lion, than an adult lion track, and we don't see the back of it. So I don't know if it was elongated or if it was shorter like it would be on a feline, a lion or a mountain lion or a cat, but it is spectacular. You can even see between where the toenails were and the toes, you can see that it had fur, and it's just spectacular. And I found right beside it another piece of the heavy equipment that broken years ago with a nice three-toed dinosaur track walking in the same substrate exactly that this giant mammal had been walking.
Now, Ray, you and I had a discussion about this one time because there is some people kind of pushing a theory that, you know, man walked beside dinosaur, and I believe it's in Texas somewhere where they went through layers of rock and they found footprints that look like human footprints next to dinosaur footprints, and you had an answer for that, right?
I have an answer for it. It's been investigated thoroughly, and one of the chief investigators of this is a personal friend of mine, and the truth of the matter is that the tracks they call man tracks, they say, well, these were giants. Well, how come these tracks are 3 feet long? Well, it was a giant. Well, it's awfully narrow. What it is that dinosaurs, flesh-eating dinosaurs, the theropods, if they heard a roar of something that might be dangerous, they would lower their profile. Or if it was so muddy that they didn't want to sink down too much, they would lower off. Their three toes normally walk down, but they keep their the metatarsals, the bows beyond the toes, upward. But they would lower their profile like a snow chute to keep you from sinking in the snow, to keep them from sinking in the mud. And that's all in the world it is. What these dishonest people trying to prove that the world's only 5,000 years old were doing, they weren't telling you or showing you upstream where the animal went upslope. And as he goes upslope, he rises up on his toes, what's called digitigrade, and went out of plantigrade. We have a fine example of this in the Goddard slab, a smaller but the same type of dinosaur. And when he walked through an area that was wet, then he lowered down on the metatarsals. But you see, as soon as it climbs up the slope, it gets back up on his toes slowly again.
Right. What causes a track to be preserved, or in this case, so many? You know, I think about people walk every day, and then how could, you know, footprints be preserved?
Yeah. People don't realize what happens. In the first place, in most of these cases, the tracks were probably exposed for a little while, maybe enough slightly dry out, or there may have been a low-grade water moved over them. And ferrophagic bacteria, these are bacteria, that means bacteria that eat iron. They get in there and they excrete hematite, and it coats it and creates basically an armor plating. In some cases, that doesn't happen, but there are bacterial slime that builds up on it. It dries out, then the water recedes, it dries out a little bit, and you've got this tiny little microscopic barrier, and then a flood comes and covers it up. But years later, when they're trying to deepen the streams, for example, here to keep water out of our streets, they cut through here and they break the upper layer off, and it exposes these layers where the tracks are. It separates that way because because mainly the bacterial mat that was there, whether it's one that was formed as iron through the iron-eating bacteria, or whether it's other types of bacteria. I think bacteria are largely responsible for enabling the substrate that's above it to separate. And sometimes we get thus the what was above it that filled the track. We've got it as where you see the track as if it were three-dimensional, and the other one beneath it where it sinks down. You've got both the top one and the bottom. Sometimes we'll find a piece, and we'll see a crack. You jar it a little bit, and it comes loose, and you've got the nice infill on one side and the track on the other. It's really nice when you're showing this to children, for example, to help them understand what was happening and how it got preserved.
How can you guess how many years span, say, for instance, that slab? It sounded like there was maybe a predator situation there, but if not, can many years go by in the same area where these things are preserved, or is this just something that is for, you know, ephemeral to say a month or a week or a day or whatever?
Well, we believe that the Goddard tracks were probably made in shortest time, a few hours, and maybe no more than a couple of days. It could have been a week, but probably not, because we don't see many stepping on top of each other. But when you look at that slab, there's the ironstone, which is brown-red, and then you'll have white. The slab weighs about 3.5 tons. But you'll see a layer of softer white stuff, and then you'll see another ironstone layer. Well, if we ever get the financing to cut that apart and dissolve the softer white area, we'll have another layer with a bunch of tracks on it, probably. We've got two other layers, I think, beneath that. These were much earlier, you see, and then as infill in the floodplain kept bringing dirt down and covering it up, then you get to an area where there was a high bacterial content of a type that would create the ironstone, and the silt wouldn't create the ironstone. But sometimes they're preserved in just siltstone or even sandstone that's been hardened by silica infusion. And so there are many ways, forms in which these can get preserved, but and you can have one on top of the other. It can get remarkable. And sometimes we have a wonderful track in which you see the track on top, you can turn it over, and you see the negative of it, you see the push down. And you can even see where in one case the dinosaur got his foot stuck in the clay and twisted it to get his toes out of the clay and lifted it out. I mean, it's almost as if you could step in a time machine and actually see it happening. It's really wonderful when you get to studying it.
Oh, I bet it's fascinating to me. Now, what about unknown or found species? Has any of that appeared in tracks themselves?
Oh, yes. Now, we can't talk of specific species of animals from tracks. We can talk about species of tracks. In other words, when you have a track that's well documented, several examples, and you can say it has certain types of form and qualities to it, then just like an animal species, you can publish it as a trace species. It's called in the papers an itsno, or trace species. And it's not telling you the species of the dinosaur. It's the species of track. For example, no one had ever found and published the tracks of a Hypsilophodon, a plant-eating dinosaur. But I repeatedly kept finding them around here, so I wrote a paper, and Martin Lockley joined me on it, and we published a paper about a new, what we would call is no species or trace species, and his name is Hypsiloichnus marylandicus. Well, obviously of Maryland, but Hypsiloichnus means the trace of a Hypsilophodon. Never been published before, but we had not only the back footprint, but the front footprint with it in two examples, one from up in Baltimore and one down here, and it was just wonderful. It tremendous documentation, and the foot, the type of the feet, both the back and the front foot, are different from what I'd ever seen on any other dinosaur. And when you get those two unique tracks together, you've definitely got a Hypsiloichnus marylandicus. So this is the Maryland gets credit for providing the first example worldwide of the tracks of a Hypsilophodon. But we have also other new species of dinosaur tracks yet to be published, and we published one in the Goddard paper, and we gave it a name that I tell you I have trouble remembering. This name, I'm 80 years old, but it had Goddard inses after Goddard, and so it we've given Goddard the credit for its it's a mammal track. So it's in other words, you have footprint species, but people should not mistake them for a species of animal. They're really just a scientific classification of the footprint, even as we classify animals as species.
Now, I know you and I have talked briefly, I don't know, maybe a few years ago about this, but I never really got your feeling on it. I kind of have mixed feelings myself. But, you know, because I'm in the fine arts and the antiques and the auction business, I kind of pay attention to things. And, you know, there was a T-Rex, you know, skeleton, basically, that was found that sold for multi-millions of dollars at auction. And I just wondered what you thought about commercializing, you know, when something goes to auction. And I know it's museums that typically want to own it, and that's the demand for it.
That's right. Well, it's a human problem that that sometimes interfaces and conflicts with scientific challenges. And I'll tell you, I am not impressed with museums paying millions of dollars for T-Rex. Everybody knows you can go to any museum you've got good T-Rex skeletons. They're not really a skeleton, but they're made of casts of the bones.
Yes.
And they look exactly like the real thing.
Yeah.
And a museum, in my opinion, has better ways to spend its money than I mean, how many kids must you give enable to say, T-Rex, I saw a T-Rex. And it's so silly. I mean, in my opinion, this Goddard slab should be on display down in the Smithsonian, and it should encourage kids to learn what they themselves can discover. When you make discoveries on there, they could have an interactive that enable them to make discoveries, and they would feel their own ability to do some rudimentary science. This is the kind of thing, not the that's all a T-Rex, but something else that goes deeper and gets inside of them and lets them know that there can be a more interesting world than what they see in that little electronic box on their hand. And I feel strongly about that. However, the curator of dinosaurs, Smithsonian, when I had made these discoveries on the slab, working on the reproduction slab, we didn't know that many tracks were on it at all. We just knew the Nodosaur track and the baby and the big sauropod track. The rest of them we didn't know. But he came over and saw it. But the thing is, unfortunately, by that time, this new wing that's going to open up at the end of next year, I think it is, they already had, as he said, every bolt and screw in the thing. It already planned. They couldn't find a way to get this in because everything was pre-designed and bought, in effect, through the contractors. And so there's nothing they could do about it. But I think that had the right display with this, and the idea that's at Goddard Space Flight Center, where astrophysicists are walking right over things, they're looking out into space millions of years and not noticing the millions of years down at their feet, I think it would have been a tremendous drawing card. There's, the little dinosaur that I have down there, and the little Nodosaur track of a junior Nodosaur that I gave them beside it, this display, I mean, it has millions of viewers a year. I forget the figure, but it's over a million. I think it was at least 2.something million people would pass through there per year. But if they had a thing like this with the map down below, by the way, are we going to be able to show any of those pictures of the dinosaur, the slab with the map?
Oh, you know what, Ray, I think there was an issue with that. Maybe I only was able to download one, and I thought they were the same. You probably sent me two. Of the terribly sorry, that's my fault.
Yeah, I'd love people to have seen it. But I'm anyway, in your promo though, you had a nice link In the promo for this, you'll find in there a nice link to a site that I had not even seen, and it shows the slab and the map that my wife and I laboriously made to explain to you the tracks. So if somebody wants to go there and click on that link, I appreciate you putting it in. They can see that for themselves and study it.
Okay. All right. Great. Let's see. We have just like, I think, 3 or 4 minutes left here, Ray. So when I visited you, we're going to shift gears a little bit, and I really appreciate your work, and I was absolutely thrilled. I'm still very thrilled of all the publicity you actually got and your great work that you did when it comes to the dinosaur tracking. It's been a lot of fun, and we've been in touch through this whole time when you've gone through this whole thing, and I'm proud of you, Ray.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. But I wanted to talk, when you gave me the tour, I was actually, that was very nice. So we spent some time with a gentleman with the last name Bartlett there, a satellite engineer, I believe, or something. But when right. you gave me the tour there at Goddard, was it the James Webb telescope that we saw them working on? I'm trying to remember what
yes.
it was. It was.
Yes, as a matter of fact, and I've had some nice conversation with the Nobel laureate who's kind of the scientific head of that project, and a very, very nice fellow. But the Bartlett you mentioned, he was responsible for the design of, I think, either 11 or 13 of the instruments that are on the MAVEN Arbiter, Mars orbiter that's in orbit now, that is studying things about the upper atmosphere that gives us clues as to what happened to change the Martian atmosphere over the ages in the past. And Bob did the design, as I said, of most, I think, of the instruments that were on there. I was amazed at how many he had the big design port in.
Yeah,
and he's the guy that took you on the nice tour around Goddard.
That's right, and I was actually impressed that him, along with other, other scientists there, that are kind of open-minded, going back to the UFO topic.
They're very open-minded. When you get them privately, I suspect some of them, if they were in the crowd of Goddard employees there, they might be a little more intimidated. I can't speak for them, but privately, I mean, they know me as a rational person who made major world-class discoveries there at Goddard, right under their feet, and they respect me. And so when I begin to talk about another type of hard evidence that we've gotten in the way of films and magnetometer and gravimeter and even spectrographic recordings, hard data from UFOs, they take notice and they realize, I'll say something, I cannot call a name, but I can say that a person with a PhD in a major physics, a field of physics, and that has had the highest levels of government clearance because of projects he's worked on, both with the Navy and with the intelligence community and an interface with NASA. He has often had lunch, and we've not called his name on this show at all. He has twice said something quite remarkable to my wife, Sheila, and me. One day he stood up one day, we were getting ready to leave, and he said, "Ray and Sheila, anybody who is anyone," and he meant in the inside of scientific research with NASA and so forth, "knows about the extraterrestrial technology," those are his exact words, he didn't say beings, but he said the extraterrestrial technology that is visiting our atmosphere. And one day, months later, he was there with his son, who was also an engineer and a scientist of some time, I don't remember exactly what, and we were sitting there talking, and he made the exact same statement in front of his son and to us. And I do not ask people who have learned things on a basis of security clearance. I think it is unfair to ask them to betray their oath to their country, because there may be reasons we don't understand for national security. I'm very cautious about what I have gotten because I realize some of it may be. This has been my major holdback, is that I feel that I've got some material that is is possibly pertinent national security. And I try to be conscious, and I never want to offend or ask anybody to offend their oath to the government in their positions of security. So I did not press this fellow further and say, wait a minute, what do you know? How do you know it? We just took him at his word.
Well, we're out of time, Ray. So I will also remind people that if you want to get that great book about the Sikora case, just to email me. Thanks so much, Ray. It's always a pleasure, a great pleasure.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. All right, everyone. So that's it for our show. And thanks so much for listening. We're going to be back next week with Terry Lovelace. Should be a real great guest. I'm really looking forward to that. And I want to thank you all for listening. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.